This is FM 100.5 and 101.9. AM 1450, Rutherford County's place to talk. WGNS, Murfreesboro, your good neighbor station. This is The Truman Show with Truman Jones. A look at the politics, news, sports, and people that are shaping Rutherford County. Now your host, Truman Jones.
And good afternoon, Rutherford County. We're going to have a great show today. We have Judy Whitehill, who is one of the brightest people that we've ever had on this show. And we want to let you know that we have something special going on this week. Caldwell Banker Barnes Auctioneers Ralph McKee and J.D. Kite have some don't-miss auctions coming up. The first is this Thursday, an absolute auction at 5:30 of a commercial building at 2223 South Park Drive. The 1,800-square-foot building was formerly used as a HVAC shop. The brick and metal building is close to the interstate for access. The property is zoned commercial, plus work trucks and tons of tools will be sold at this absolute auction this Thursday. Get more details at CaldwellBankerAuctions.com. Absolute auction this Thursday, 2223 South Park Drive. And then on Saturday, the estate of Joan Bell will be sold at auction, and it's beginning at 10 a.m. A brick ranch home at 1918 Wiltshire Drive, over 2,300 square feet, will sell at 12 noon. The well-maintained home has a living room, formal dining room, kitchen, den, master bedroom, and two additional bedrooms. See pictures and find out more at CaldwellBankerAuctions.com. CaldwellBankerAuctions.com. Personal property will be sold before the homes beginning at 10 a.m., including couches, a desk table, glassware, appliances, bedroom sets, tools, and more. Wiltshire Drive is just off Thompson Lane. Call 893-1130 for more information. That's 893-1130, or go to 893-1130, or go to CaldwellBankerAuctions.com. Ralph McKee and J.D. Kite will see you this afternoon and this week at the auction. Okay, I think we have a caller on the line, Judy. We have to put our ears on. Okay, caller, welcome aboard.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, uh-huh.
I just had a question to start off regarding the political atmosphere of the county. It seems there have been, regarding the county mayor, whenever he ran for re-election, he's constantly said there's going to be no new taxes, but yet... our school system is over $5 million in the hole, and all this new infrastructure we're building, all the expenses of the county, it seems that we are slowly depleting our reserve funds for the county. And it appears that with the recent stories regarding the property assessor, Bill Boner, it seems that they might be possibly somehow working together. I don't know how. That's my question, is people's property values are going down, but yet the assessments of their homes keep going up. It seems like it's kind of a stealth tax to kind of help the county grow some funds without saying we raise taxes. And I was wondering what your views on that was.
Well, actually, I am not informed enough about some of the things that you're talking about, but we are going to talk about education today. And Judy Whitehill is an expert in that particular area. And we are going to talk some about the questions that you're talking about.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Okay, Judy. We were talking earlier, and thank you. I dropped my glasses on the floor. We were talking earlier about some of the things that are going on in education, and one of the areas that the gentleman called and asked about, of course, is the funding of education. And that's always been, to me, a very complicated issue because there are so many places that generate the funds for education. One would be the federal, the one is the state, and also local. And sometimes it's hard to put a finger on it, but you know as probably as well as anybody, more than most, that there always catches to some of the funding that comes into education, and you're trying to provide the best education possible for our kids here. It's very difficult, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Well, first of all, thank you, Truman, for the opportunity to be
here to
and talk today. And you're right, because the funding for education, for public education, isn't just the single entity from your local. It's your federal, your state, and your local. And so many of the provisions that are put on school systems deal with unfunded mandates.
Right.
They will put these provisions on as to how you are to serve the students in certain populations. Things, there needs to be extra equipment and a lot of extra expenses built in, but those funds don't come down from the federal level or even from the state sometimes, so that falls to the local to pick it up. And I know that maybe the average taxpayer sometimes doesn't understand, if their property taxes go up, they don't understand why more money might be going to the schools. But when you have a community and a town like Murfreesboro that's grown so much over the last 15 or 20 or 25 years and continues to grow because of its quality of life, you are going to have people attracted to our town, and of course they're going to have children, and there's going to be needs in the school. So the county and the city both have had the responsibility of building additional schools, because you have to have adequate areas for students to be able to learn. And it seems like for people maybe who don't have children in the system, that there's always money going to the schools, you know, and they're sometimes upset about that, but they don't sometimes realize how costly it is to do some of the things you need to do now to keep us in the forefront in education. We were talking earlier about technology. You know, anyone who goes into a store to look at buying a computer or any element of technology realizes how costly it is and how frequently it changes. And we can't be in the classroom training students for the future if we're working with equipment that's 20 years old and dated. So that's just one small example of the cost in a school.
Now, when they put mandates on the school system for the money that they're funding, and let's take it on a federal level, and maybe some of those requirements are not really a positive issue for the teacher in the classroom. How do you deal with that? Because you know that if you do not obey their particular rules, then they're going to pull that money away from you.
And that's a real problem, and has been for many years. When I started teaching in 1973, they had just enacted the laws at the federal level that made sure that children with special needs would have everything they needed in the classroom. Well, if you have a small rural community or a small county where financially you can't afford to have one teacher who maybe, for example, knows sign language and can work with children who are hearing impaired, then that school system has to contract with an adjoining county that does have someone in place. So they've got to pay transportation to take that student there for classes. There's an extra cost that they have to bear. And while every teacher and every educator will tell you that that's tremendously important and that we want to meet the needs of those students, if that money isn't coming from the federal level, it has to be picked up by the local or the state. And so what happens is you have a real disadvantage when you've got small counties that can afford to put those teachers in place, and then they've got to spend all those extra funds. And, of course, that takes away from other programs that they might have or might need. And it's just almost like they're giving you things with one hand and taking it away with the other. And actually, as far as I know, the amount of money that they promised back in 1973 has never been fully funded. And here we are 40 years down the road.
It seems like it's always catch-up, isn't it?
It is.
No matter what it is that you're dealing with, you're promised the moon, but yet it seems to never shine as bright as it should.
Exactly. And, you know, part of that problem, I think, and I believe if you would talk to experienced educators, you'd find it out, it's because the ones who are making those decisions aren't really practitioners themselves. They, you know, they went to public schools in many cases, but they haven't taught, and they may not even have children in public schools. And so it's really hard sometimes for them to be making those decisions because they don't come and ask the ones who are most impacted by it. If they would ask teachers, I think they would find out some of the things that are necessary. It might keep them from making some of the mistakes they've made. One of the things that Governor Ned McWhorter did many years ago that was very, very smart was to ask the teachers, what do you really need to make you effective in the classroom and help your students? Strangely enough, they didn't say, I need more salary, I need more benefits. They said, we need smaller classes, we need to make sure we've got the technology that we need, and we need to make sure we've got the facilities and in an appropriate work and learning environment. And that's when he worked with the legislature and they began to fund it so that we were really able at that time to do a lot of building, you know, to get some more schools in place and to add extra rooms on so that you don't have overcrowded classrooms. We got a lot of technology. We had training for the teachers to help them use that technology properly. That's more of what we need. We don't need more rules in place, and we sure don't need more tests.
Well, you know, the pressure is so terrible right now on the teachers and the principals and the superintendent and everybody involved with education, and yet, I mean, they're working so hard to be able to publicize all the great things that they're doing, but the one thing that seems to be left out would be the students themselves. They're the ones that you're trying to prepare for the future so that they can be successful, and if they've got all this pressure put on them with aptitudes that are not going to fit that level, I mean, it's just a license for failure.
Well, you know, what people sometimes forget is that all students are different and unique.
Right.
I've even talked to people who have more than one child, and I'll say, think about your own children. Do they all walk at the same time? Do they all talk at the same time? Do they have the same interests? Oh, no, no. So-and-so, you know, walk faster. This one talk faster. This one has an aptitude for gymnastics. This one's in sports. This one loves to read. And then I'll say, well, think about having a classroom of 20 to 25 children from all different backgrounds, different experiences, different families. And you are telling a teacher to start at one level and bring them all up to the same level at the end of the school year. That's not reasonable. And children are not products that you put through a machine and produce a product. You know, they're not like in a car factory, because you can control the quality of materials that you have if you're going to build fenders or motors or whatever. But when children come to our schools, we take them for whatever ability levels they have. Mm-hmm. You know, they could have had an opportunity to go to preschool, or maybe they didn't. So teachers don't get to pick and choose. They take every child at the level and they work with them. And sometimes when people are only looking at numbers, they kind of disregard the fact that we aren't all starting at the same level. Mm-hmm. And that makes it very, very difficult for teachers who know how to work with these children on an individual level. They're just not being given that opportunity because of all the heavy mandates with testing and all the evaluations and things that don't really add to the quality of instruction.
How in the world do you get the word out to the general public to let them know all the things that are involved that are going on in education today that were not even part of the equation 15, 20, 30 years ago?
Well, I think it's that expression, a picture is worth 1,000 words. Mm-hmm. It would, you know, I could spend 4 days on your show talking about it. But if individuals who really want to see what's going on would take the opportunity to come into a classroom, whether it's a neighbor's child that they're visiting in the classroom or children or grandchildren, and just see all that teachers do and all that's expected of them, I think it might give them a new appreciation. A lot of times people have their experience of school is what they remember from their own school years, and things have certainly changed. I mean, I've only been out of the classroom since 2002, and that's 10 years, and I can't imagine all the things that have changed in technology and everything else. So I can't imagine what it would be like for someone who has been out of the school system for 20 or 30 years. I think they need to see all that's going on, the great things that are going on, and all the good instruction, how you can meet needs of individual students, all the special programs they've got. I think if they could see that, they then might be an advocate for our schools, and it might make them feel better about the way their tax money is spent, and it might make them more liable to support people who are making those decisions, whether it be school board members or legislators or whoever.
You know, it seems to me like, especially in the last couple of years, it has become more of a political situation, and when those type things happen, you don't really get a realistic look at what's happened. I mean, you can put the perception out in glowing terms and all of that, but the buck stops right in the classroom. I mean, it seems like that the goals that are put on the teachers are so tough right now, and I know a number of teachers that have retired early, and some of the new teachers that have gone in felt like that the classroom was a place that didn't seem like what they really thought it was going to be. And I was thinking back when in law enforcement, one of the things that we always had a hard time was keeping good, experienced people who knew how to do their job in place, because there's always someplace looking for someone who really wanted that type of person. And it's got to be tough in education to be able to keep up with that process, having kids that have gone through college and now they're ready to go into the classroom, and then all of a sudden they hit a brick wall and this is not what I want to do. Are we going to be in a situation where we're going to be continually teaching and training these people?
Yes. Unfortunately, well, let me start with what you said about losing good teachers. We have lost many teachers who became eligible for retirement but would have probably stayed another 5 to 10 years because they love teaching, only because now some of the fun, the creativity, the spontaneity has been taken out of being able to teach, being able to meet those individual needs because you've got this heavy testing mandate. Now, talking about the new teachers, we've seen over the past maybe 15, 20 years, teachers were staying 5 to 7 years, new teachers, and then they were leaving. What we're seeing now is that they're only staying 1 or 2 years because they're frustrated. Part of the problem is when you come out of the university, you may know your subject matter, but you may need lots of experience with how to manage classrooms, especially the diversity that you find in classrooms nowadays, with sometimes children not speaking English as a primary language, with learning disabilities, with autism, with so many things now, and the children are in inclusion is part of our terminology. You know, we include everyone in the classroom instead of pull-out programs so many times. So you've got a teacher who's had maybe maybe 2 months, 3 months of actual teaching experience as a student teacher, and then he or she comes into the schools, and they know their subject matter, but knowing how to set up a classroom and knowing how to have established classroom rules and classroom management, all this, it's such a difficult thing. And if they don't have those experienced teachers who now, as I said, are leaving, they don't have a mentor, someone to draw on, someone to go down the hall after school and say, I'm having difficulty. Can you help me? Can you give me assistance? And teachers have always wanted to do that. They've always been inclined to help and to share, provide lesson plans for other teachers and to help work in their grade groups. But because you're losing those experienced teachers, the young teachers don't have that to fall back on, and they are very frustrated, and it has nothing to do with salaries. Yes, salaries could be a lot more, but at the same time, the working conditions are so frustrating, and they're not getting that support that they need. And that all comes back to the strict testing that's taken away the work environment where people like to work together and collaborate and share. Now it's become more competitive because you're thinking, well, you know, if I give my lesson plans to someone, then they're going to get a better evaluation maybe than me. We would never advocate having that competitive type of environment in the schools. It might work if you're on a sports team and you want to beat another sports team, but it's not good for classrooms and for public education, certainly not for students.
Well, I remember a time when the classrooms were structured And the children, when they walked into that classroom, they belonged to the school. They really did. And if something happened that was inappropriate, it was taken care of at that time. Discipline was not just a word. I mean, you took care of things. That's been taken out of the classroom. There have been so many things that the teacher has to deal with on a different level than when I went to school and probably when you went to school.
Right.
Because I was watching something, or actually I was reading on the internet today about over in Iraq, they were going to have a movie and all the soldiers were there. And before they show the movie, the soldiers stand at attention and they play the Star Spangled Banner. And they got about three quarters through playing the Star Spangled Banner and it went off. It just quit. Everybody stood at attention, did not blink an eye, and they played it again. It did the same thing. They were in a structured environment where they respected everything around them. Instead of going back and playing it again, one person started singing the rest of the Star Spangled Banner. And then they all joined in. And it's something like that that really grabs me. And it seems like, and part of it was written by the chaplain who was there. And he basically said, if this would have been 17 and 18 year olds, they probably wouldn't have been standing at attention to start with. They would have been talking. And that seems to be part of what we're missing and losing right now. And it really did get me because I was sitting there. I know how the military is. They do structure young men and young women now,
right,
and turn them into something. Is that something that's going to be absent from the classroom?
Well, you know, I don't know. My son is in the military. He's actually in the Air Force. He's a first lieutenant. So I do know about the discipline and the structure that he has talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And I do see a huge change from when I was in school. And, you know, it was the kind of thing where even in a neighborhood, if you misbehaved, one of the neighbor's parents would tell your parents, and they knew by the time you got home. But
double jeopardy.
It is double jeopardy. But but it is very difficult now because so much of what teachers want to do is to have rules that everyone follow, but sometimes you will have a child who, because of maybe an individual education plan, IEP, mm-hmm. doesn't do well with certain rules, and you have to make some modifications. And it's really hard sometimes for children to see someone else not having to follow that rule and for them to understand that they have to. So mm-hmm. some of those things are in place. But, you know, discipline is a very tough thing for educators, and which is what I was saying about those young teachers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could know everything you need to know about your subject matter, algebra, English, whatever it is you're teaching, but you can't be a sage on the stage. You can't assume that everyone wants to hear what you have to say, and it's tough for those young people to know how to get the respect and discipline in their classroom. So it's probably as much of a society problem as anything.
But the classroom is the society
that's
problem.
That's right. Well, it does. It reflects.
Right.
I mean, the classroom, what's happening now is reflective of what's happening in society. So,
well, we're going to have to put our ears back on, Judy.
Right.
Caller, welcome aboard with Judy Whitehill.
Hello. Yeah, I was just wanting to, a gentleman earlier had mentioned Bill Boner, the property assessor, and I've been keeping track with what was going on with the accusations that several women have brought up, and from what I understand, there are more accusations and more people who may not even work with him now coming forward with things, and I was just kind of wanting some input on how you both feel about that whole situation and, you know, us paying for him to treat people that way, pretty much with tax dollars, and just to kind of see what it would take to get somebody out of office, like how many accusations have to be made.
Well, that is something that we really don't discuss here, or accusations or things like that. And basically, we have certain issues that we do deal with, but basically, we try to keep it non-political if any way possible. And I appreciate you calling, but right now, we're going to stick to the education issue. Okay.
The Bungin' Up Pig is back and better than ever in the borough.
My name is Mary Fugit. I work for TriStar Title Company, and I had to come today to the Bungin' Up Pig because when my husband and I had our first date a couple of years ago, he brought me here for drinks and dancing, and it was the best time.
Join the Bungin' Up Pig every Tuesday night for live music. The Bungin' Up Pig on Northfield in the Georgetown Square.
This is Good Neighbor Events, brought to you by AmeriCare Pest Control, the Rutherford Home Show, Saturday mornings at 11:30 on WGNS, and the Omni Hut Restaurant in Smyrna.
If you're planning to buy a home, choose a professional that will look out for you. Ann Hoken Associates has a proven track record of helping guide clients through the home buying experience. Whether buying your first home, moving up, downsizing, or investing, Ann's team will help you do it right. When it's your time to buy or sell, just ask Ann.
This is Ann Hoke of Keller Williams Realty. I would love to personally talk with you. Call me today at 397-4024. Sell faster and buy smarter with Ann Hoke and Associates.
Let's check those Good Neighbor events. Now, this coming Thursday night, it's the CASA Fundraiser. That's up at the Maple Street Uncorked, right above the Maple Street Grill. 5 until 7 this coming Thursday night. It all benefits the court-appointed Special Advocate Program. While you're there, you can learn more about the CASA program and how you can volunteer to make a difference in young persons' lives. For information, call CASA at 904-6996. Again, that fundraiser coming up this Thursday night, 5 until 7, at Maple Street Uncorked. Oh yes, early voting begins Friday. This Friday, early voting. That's for the Tennessee primary and Rutherford County general elections. Early voting starts Friday. And the musical 13 opens Friday night at 7 at the Center for the Arts in Uptown Murfreesboro. It runs through July the 29th on Friday and Saturday nights at 7 and Sunday matinees at 2. In neighboring Woodbury, the musical Legally Blonde, Friday and Saturday night at 7:30 with a 2 o'clock Sunday matinee. That's at the Arts Center of Cannon County. And Uncle Dave Makin' Days is this coming Friday through Sunday over at Cannonsburg. Don't you dare miss that one. Those are Good Neighbor events.
Hi, I'm Dr. Britt Miaton, a cardiologist with St. Thomas Heart at Middle Tennessee Medical Center. Did you know that St. Thomas Heart is Middle Tennessee's number one rated heart program? At MTMC, we offer comprehensive services for the treatment and prevention of heart disease. From early diagnosis to minimally invasive surgical procedures, St. Thomas Heart at MTMC offers you heart care close to home. For information, visit heartasone.com or call 867-5028.
My name is Dale Corbett. 14 years ago, after 25 years of military service, I was hired as the county engineer. Based on my engineering degree and my years of professional experience as a registered engineer, I'm running for the position of Rutherford County Highway Superintendent. I'm the only registered engineer running in this race. I care about this community, and I'll be looking out for our safety. Early voting begins July 13th. I would appreciate your vote, paid for by friends to elect Dale Corbett Treasurer.
The Truman Show now continues on the voice of Rutherford County, WGNS, AM and FM.
And welcome back with Judy Whitehill, and we want to let you know that this part of her show is brought to you by At Home Care, and that's Melissa Warren's business. She saw a need because there were people in the community that were no longer able to take care of their responsibilities at home, and it looked like that they may have to take another avenue and maybe go to somewhere where they're away from their home. Well, you don't have to do that anymore. Melissa started this business to make sure that you can stay at home. You don't have to take care of your responsibilities there. They run errands for you. They take care of all your needs, and all you have to do is sit back and enjoy life. And if that sounds great to you, give them a call at 713-4639 or pull them up on the internet, www.athomecaretennessee.com. Well, Judy, I mean, we can go all over the place with education, and there's so many things that we can talk about. And, of course, one that I really like, of course, is the magnet school. It kind of reminds me of when we were going to school years ago. And it's based on accomplishments and people who have the aptitude, and they're responsible for making sure that they accomplish all of their goals while they're in school. And then you have the charter schools. Now, relate the differences in those two schools, or those two different types of schools, in the regular classrooms in general education.
Well, a magnet school is generally within the structure of your public school system. Mm-hmm. And what it does is it allows you to attract students who usually have higher levels of achievement, mm-hmm. and they may be wanting to do some or major in some particular subject matter, mm-hmm. or take some courses that would be difficult to give in several different schools because you may only have one instructor who can address those issues. And if you only have two or three students in several schools, it's hard to accomplish that. So if you can have a magnet school and have a teacher, for example, who teaches Latin, and you can have all the students there together to learn Latin, then you are being able to help save resources because you don't have to have a Latin teacher in every school. And it also allows a school system to put the resources in targeting various things, whether it's engineering or just whatever it is that's an interest to students. And it does help them, you know, have that peer interaction of people who are high achievers. Mm-hmm. So that's something that's been in place for a while in various school systems across the country. Mm-hmm. Now, a charter school is different in that it is, at least in Tennessee, mm-hmm. it's run by your public school systems, but you have a different management system, a group somewhere who comes in and will take on a charter school. It could be in an existing building, or it could be like an abandoned shopping center, whatever. Mm-hmm. They agree to take whatever funds that the school would allocate for a school, and they give it to this management group to operate it. And within that budget, they've got to be able to hire teachers and to have all the coursework in place. Mm-hmm. What they don't have are some of the same restrictions, like they don't have to provide sports, they don't have to provide transportation, they can advocate for having parents come in and put in a certain number of hours a week for their students, they can extend the school day, they can extend the school week, all those kinds of things. They have that latitude. What we always felt like was so important was that they still have to evaluate the same method. In other words, you can't compare an apple to an orange. They're both fruit, but they taste and look very different. So if you're going to have a charter school and you're going to say, we're going to give you the latitude to lengthen or shorten your day or teach more math than you do science or whatever, your students are still going to have to perform on the same standardized tests that the public school systems do. Mm-hmm. That's what we as public school advocates have been saying the whole time. Mm-hmm. But the money doesn't leave the school system. Now, let me go a step further, something you didn't mention, that's vouchers.
Okay.
Vouchers are basically a for-profit type of incentive. Years ago, people who wanted to privatize medicine and privatize other things that had basically not been necessarily private, saw the money that was available out there in public education and all the school systems, and they thought, well, we can take that money and we can run a school cheaper and then we'll have a profit. Never should you look at children and their education as a for-profit. And that's one of the biggest concerns that I, as a retired educator right now, see in what's happening across the country. Because I believe that there are kind of fly-by-night organizations in some cases. Some may have some real substance. But a lot of people think, if I take this many thousands of dollars, I can have a school in abandoned building, and I can hire my teachers. I won't pay them very much, but I will require that they teach 6 days a week and 10 hours a day and all this, and we'll bring our scores up. That's the kind of thing that has not proven successful. We've had some successes in charter schools, and I think magnet schools are great, but the voucher system is not the way to go because you're going to shortchange children and teachers when you do that, when you're trying to make a profit.
Yeah, you and I have heard for years, we both work in government, and that if you privatize things, you can do it better, and cheaper. And, you know, for some reason, I have never seen that come true. I know that they've got these private corrections institutions. And we were the very first one that they came to years ago. And they would build the jail, and they would run the jail, and we had the figures on how much they would be making and all that. And the funny thing about it is they could do it cheaper up to a certain level of population there. But once it went beyond that, then they were making a pretty good amount of money. And so you think about it, well, if I'm a private business owner and I know that I can make more money with more people in that jail, I'm going to make sure that there's more people in that jail or in that prison or whatever. And private companies seem to get and want to get involved in government business for one reason only, and that's for profit. I mean, that's the reason that you get into a business. And you know as well as I do that there are private entities already involved in the school system, well, either in testing, grading testing, or whatever. It's still there.
I remember many years ago in Murfreesboro City Schools when they investigated having all of our, not maintenance, but our housekeeping involved. They brought in a company, I don't know, maybe Ohio or somewhere. And so instead of having our regular custodians who had done a great job of keeping our school system clean, they hired individuals who were told, you know, don't try to keep as much of the cleaning products on hand because we're trying to keep our costs down, and don't use as much tissue paper and paper towels and all this. What we found over a period of a year was that our schools were not as clean. The individuals themselves weren't of the community, so they didn't have a vested interest. You know, when we hire people in the community, they're proud of their schools. They want to keep it clean. They want to be able to showcase the schools. And so after a year, the school system said, this isn't working. So they did away with that contract, and they went back to hiring people individual in the schools. And I just think that you lose some of the ownership when you contract out. And sometimes those businesses will even say to the individual, well, if you save us money, then you will get an incentive. So they themselves have an incentive to keep the cost down. And while keeping costs down is okay, you still got to provide the services and you've got to meet expectations. And that's what I don't see when you have private companies come in many times.
It's my understanding, and I've gotten this from teachers, that sometimes when the tests come in, the answers to the questions are not always accurate. So the teachers have to make sure that they check those, which causes them more problems, yes, to make sure that the answers are the ones they're supposed to be. You know, I find that kind of amusing that the teachers are constantly being graded by people who really don't have the education or the background to do what they're doing.
Exactly. Well, that's one of the problems that many teachers have had for a long time with standardized testing, because things, you know yourself, things in Murfreesboro and things in Tennessee are different from in California or New York or Maine or Washington.
Or Wisconsin.
And so what you have test makers in one central location, and they're asking questions that might not be relative in a particular area. Sometimes even the way a word is used is different depending on the dialect or the context. And so students get very confused. And so what you're doing is you don't have a standard curriculum, but yet you have a standardized test. It's standardized, and yet you're not really, your curriculum doesn't match it up. And then you don't want to get in the position where you're actually teaching to the test, because that takes away any creativity or spontaneity.
Right.
One of the things that always bothered me when we were doing standardized testing was we trust our teachers to be able to teach our students, but when it came to testing, it was like we didn't trust them. We had to send in monitors or proctors. And as a librarian, since I didn't have a regular classroom to administer a test to, I would be assigned to teachers to go and help during their time when they were giving tests. Well, when you're giving a test and it's very strict and timed and all this, you want some assistance. So I could go in, and if a child accidentally dropped their pencil, I could be there with another one so they could continue on and pick up papers and help and all this. Well, some of my friends told me this year the proctors weren't allowed to do anything. They were just in there to watch the teacher. And to me, that is such a distrustful attitude. It's like, we trust you to teach our children, but we don't trust you to test them. That is such an oxymoron. I mean, it's just so wrong. And the signal it sends to our teachers is just one of, well, I mean, if they have a morale problem now, you know, what's it like at the end of the year after you've struggled and you've worked your hardest to help these children, and then all of a sudden someone says, well, I'm going to watch every move you make because I'm just not sure if you're honest. That's a horrible thing to do to our educators, whether they've taught 1 year or 30.
Is this part of something that came out of Florida some time ago where the teachers were supposedly cheating for the students because there was so much pressure of achievement that would go on to their scores?
Right. Well, and yes, because there was a lot of pressure, that's when some of that started. But again, that's like a couple of isolated situations.
Right.
We were talking about this before. You know, you don't want to get in the habit of saying to any profession that, you know, you're not worthy because you're in their profession because there have been some problems. You could find errors in any profession and you can find the negative. But it's unfortunate, it seems like, that all the media focus has been on those few exceptions and not the norm. And I guess what that says is we have put too much emphasis on testing, that if that's what people have started to do, it's wrong, they shouldn't do it. But maybe we need to rethink the emphasis we're putting on testing. If you were to ask someone our age, what do you remember about school? You're probably going to say, well, I remember a unit that we did on the Native Americans. It was real interesting. Mm-hmm. And we went to a museum, and I remember this particular special project and all that. You're not going to say, oh, I remember the day we got to sit and bubble in on a test.
Mm-hmm.
What we're doing is we're really taking away from the experiences that children should be having in school, the thinking processes, the stepping outside the box, because we're saying to them, you've got to take this test. Doesn't matter if you want to or not. Doesn't matter if it really relates to what you've learned. You just got to endure. And that's a sad thing for our students. And I'm afraid 10 years down the road, this nation of test takers aren't going to be our creative thinkers that we want. When we like to compare ourselves to Germany and Japan and all the other countries in education, they're not that test heavy.
World War II. Listening to the veterans from that particular war will tell you that one of the reasons that we were so successful against especially the Germans was that they were creative. They could use their minds to adapt to different things, while the Germans were basically had on blinders and were going straight forward. And once they would lose their officers, then they were at risk. I mean, it was easy to take over them. And one of the things that, you know, I mentioned Wisconsin a moment ago, but the teachers in Tennessee are entirely different. They were the makeup is different. You had bargaining powers, but part of the bargaining powers would be what you would be doing in the classroom. And that's one of the things that has made you guys so successful over the years. And once you take that ability and the input out, then to me, the biggest failure is going to be for the kids in the classroom. And who knows more than a teacher on what's going on in that particular room?
That's exactly right. When we asked for bargaining rights back in 1979, it was to provide a better learning environment for the students. And a teacher's work environment is a student's learning environment.
Mm-hmm.
I started out as a speech therapist, and I had a van, and I moved from school to school to school, and I had to plug up an electrical unit, and you know, I just did those because I was young and experienced, and I was told to do that. That wasn't the best learning environment for my students because I was outside the school. They had to leave the building to run through inclement weather to get to my class, and it was really dangerous in many cases. Well, after talking with people, they realized it was important that my classes be inside. But I was, what I was trying to relate to them was, if the students recognize that the room we've got is adequate for our purposes, then that class becomes important to them.
Mm-hmm.
If it's something, if you meet on the playground to try to have a class, it doesn't really send that signal to the student that this is an important situation that you're in. That's why it's so important to have adequate class size, to have nice school rooms and this sort of thing, because it does give an impression to the student. This is important because you've got a workspace here. This means that you need to attend to what's happening in the classroom. Mm-hmm. I had a gentleman, actually it was Nelson Andrews, who was the chairman mm-hmm. of the state board when I served on the state board, mm-hmm. a brilliant businessman, very successful. But he said to me one day, he said, Judy, he said, isn't it true that a good teacher could teach in a barn? And I said, well, you know, Nelson, I guess it's possible, but why would you ask them to do that? Would you give a doctor needle and thread and say, do heart surgery? Mm-hmm. Would you give a scientist a small microscope and say, discover the cure for cancer? I said, mm-hmm. you have to respect the professional and give them the materials and the resources they need to be most effective. And I think that, you know, that's what for the longest time, because teachers, because they love their students, they enjoy mm-hmm. what they're doing, they've pulled money out of their own pocket and they've subsidized their classrooms for so long that now people expect that. That's not going to happen anymore. People, you know, young professionals coming into it, they're just not going to do that anymore. If the resources aren't there, they're not going to supplement it. So who's going to lose? Our students. So it's got to be that people understand resources have to be there to have all the materials you need. You don't have to have a Taj Mahal, but you mm-hmm. have to have adequate resources and ample resources to be able to do the job that you're being given when you have a curriculum and when you have guidelines from your local and your state government.
Now, if you're a teacher now and everything is so structured for you on how you're supposed to be doing things, almost like in a robotic state, how are they going to get through to the students without being chastised or maybe even lose their jobs?
Well, see, that is a problem, and that's why I say that the creativity and spontaneity has been cut out. Used to, you know how you can just have a really teachable moment? It might not be mm-hmm. in your lesson plans, but something that comes up in conversation with the students is just a perfect time to be able to lend to give a lesson. Mm-hmm. Those opportunities are taken away because it's almost like you have a script and you're going. I had a fourth grade teacher once. I just dearly loved her, and she was telling a story about her sons. She had two sons, and on Saturday she would always try to give them a small allowance. She had a dime that she tried to give both brothers, both sons. Mm-hmm. One of them insisted on giving a nickel. He thought because the nickel was larger, it was more money. So for the longest time, she gave this son a nickel because he insisted. Mm-hmm. Well, when he finally realized that the dime was twice as much, he was really angry with his mother, and she told him the fact that that was something he wanted. Mm-hmm. But what that taught me, and I hope some of my classmates, was you don't always see the value in something just by looking at it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's sometimes things down the road that you have to learn, and just the appearance of something isn't always what you think it might be. And just that dime and nickel story stuck with me because it made me think you don't judge someone by what they look like, and you don't judge someone by what they say. You get to know them and understand them and that sort of thing. That was a very teachable moment mm-hmm. when I was there with her in fourth grade. Now, with all the curriculum and all the testing, I doubt those moments happen very often, and that's a real loss.
You know, one thing, it's so different. You talk about magnet schools. You have kids that are overachievers in a lot of situations, but they are out there to make sure that they get a good education, and their parents are behind them 100%. And you know that when they come home with all of their schoolwork, that mom and dad, one, is going to be there with them during the time. How is that different than a regular school? I know that a number of teachers put in for Central and McFadden in those particular schools that are magnet schools, because they can see the beauty of having those kids come in that are going to be interested in what they're teaching. Will we ever get to a state where the normal schools, the public schools, are going to be that much of an opportunity for the teachers coming in?
Well, I think what you'll find, though, when you talk to teachers, there are many teachers who really enjoy working with a diverse group of children. Mm-hmm. They like the interactions and the challenges. Mm-hmm. And many of our children have situations at home where, because of finances, their parents have to work long
right.
hours, and they would love, those parents would love to come in and interact mm-hmm. with their children on a daily basis and have more interaction with their children, but they can't. So unfortunately, that's not always going to be something that you'll see in every single school. But I have mm-hmm. to say that we have great public schools in Rutherford County, Murfreesboro City, where parents try to do as much as they can. Even if they do have full-time jobs, they try to be active and help in fundraisers and, you know, opportunities for their children and all that sort of thing. It is nice when you do have a group of children who all want to achieve and mm-hmm. succeed in a magnet school. But I think we have a lot of opportunities in our other schools as well. It's just a matter of sometimes giving those students and those parents a little bit more support and making some opportunities available for them after work hours or on the weekend or something so that they can support their children too. You're never going to have equal footing. You know, we've never really had it, although it certainly is a bigger, wider span than it is now's haves and have-nots. But I was glad to see this morning in the Murfreesboro paper that Hobgood is expanding, that they're mm-hmm. getting some new facilities, because so many times when you build a new school, the ones that are older kind of get forgotten, and mm-hmm. I've seen that happen. And so I'm glad to see that they're not forgetting that we have a population that needs some new classrooms and needs to branch out and this sort of thing. That's why it's important, whether you're the director of schools or school board, that you keep that in mind, that you've got all these children that you're trying to meet their needs. And it's a challenge. It's nothing easy, but you have to keep your finger on it to know that you don't just keep building new schools everywhere and forget about the ones that have been there a while.
Yeah, I saw the picture and it makes me feel old, because I remember when they built that school.
Well, I remember when they built that new section that they're mm-hmm. adding on to now. It was the brand new section, I guess, probably in the late 70s, mm-hmm. Where they had some new classrooms and that sort of thing. I actually taught in part mm-hmm. of that at Hobgood. So,
you were talking about the diversity. The new system that's set up, it really makes a teacher go into the classroom with their hands handcuffed behind their back, mm-hmm. because they're having to put people with different aptitudes, different likes and needs, all on the same level. And
right.
what are you going to do with that?
It's very hard for them to make any kind of lesson plans to address all the different needs. And you're trying, you know, because I talked about IEPs, where one child maybe needs to learn visually, another one does better auditorily. You're trying to meet all these needs, and then it comes down to assessing them, and you're assessing them sometimes in the very same way with that standardized test, which isn't fair. Teachers have always assessed. They do informal assessing, then they do the formal testing, and it's just much more of a challenge for them now. It's not an 8-to-3 job by any stretch of the imagination. These teachers take things home and work till midnight, and they are working there on the weekends. You can drive past any school in the school year and see cars there where teachers are working throughout the weekend trying to get their classes ready for the week. It's tough.
If you guys were paid by the hour,
oh,
I wonder.
Oh, my gosh. We'd make more than some of those super athletes.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Judy Whitehill.
If you want to get some barbecue, I tell you how to do it. Head for the Slick Pig and you're into it. Just walk through the door at 1920 East Main and your nose will send a message right to your brain.
Now at Slick Pig Barbecue, try the Catfish Special. Wednesday night between 4 and 8 o'clock, $9.99 plus tax for all-you-can-eat catfish. The meal includes hush puppies, white beans, and homemade coleslaw at Slick Pig Barbecue.
Join special kids for our annual fundraiser banquet on Thursday, July 19th at World Outreach Church. This event is a time to celebrate and support the life-changing work at Special Kids. Member of the Dave Ramsey Speakers Bureau, author and blogger John Acuff will share his humorous insights, while dinner will be provided by Demas's Restaurant. Tickets are $100 and can be purchased online at specialkidstn.com or by calling 615-893-4892.
The local conversation continues now on The Truman Show. Once again, here's Truman Jones.
And welcome back with Judy Whitehill. We want to let you know that this part of her show is brought to you by Gordon Ralston Photography at 315 Hickerson Drive in Murfreesboro. And you can reach them at 615-396-8776. and or on the internet, www.gordonralstonphoto.com. And Al Gordon, a master craftsman photographer, and Larry Ralston, certified craftsman, both hometown guys, are the most awarded studio in the Middle Tennessee area, operating a full-service photographic studio in Murfreesboro. They specialize in weddings, high school seniors, and family portraits. Their work is classic, yet current with a creative edge. Al was even awarded the Grand Award for the best wedding image in the world. Gordon Ralston, they look forward to meeting you and will treat you like family. You know, talking about kids in school should be just an enjoyable subject, because you know I love the eagerness in their eyes and when they're out there trying to learn new things. And as you get along in the classes and you go up to the teen years and things like that, have you ever had the opportunity to watch them grow from year to year and see how they're progressing in their education?
Well, actually, as a matter of fact, after I was a speech therapist for 16 years, I became a library media specialist. Mm-hmm. And I had the opportunity to have children from kindergarten all the way through sixth grade. Mm-hmm. And I did have that experience. You know, I would have them coming in as kindergartners, and mm-hmm. I would do storytelling and puppetry and that type mm-hmm. of thing. And then by the time they were in sixth grade, it was interesting to watch them, how they might want to research a particular subject, or mm-hmm. how they were interested in a subject or an author, and how you could help them expand their interests. You know, mm-hmm. they'd say, well, I really like this book. Is there another mm-hmm. one like it? And you'd say, well, not exactly like it, but here's another author who writes some of the same subject matter and this sort of thing. So, yeah, it's really great. And I'll tell you what's even more interesting is that once you have them leave sixth grade, they come back when they're in high school. Maybe they've got a free day off, and they'll mm-hmm. come back, and they'll come in. They would come in the library, and they'd say, wow, it just looks so different now, because, of course, they're older and larger, and, yeah. and the library maybe is not as big as they thought it was. But they'd say, I remember some of the stories you read, and they'd go walking around trying to find a favorite book that they had. Mm-hmm. And then when you see them as adults, and I've even had the opportunity to have children whose parents I taught, and that is a real interesting observation to see how they remembered what you taught them and their interactions in school. So it is exciting, and I think that's what educators who really want to be there and who really want to make it their profession, that's what they live for. I mean, they really enjoy helping students. They're there because it's a call for them. It's mm-hmm. a calling.
You know, for me, it's almost like there's a big separation in generations, because we're in the age of computers and electronics and all those other things, and they even learn differently than what we would learn when we did. Because I can still, if I go into a store and I give someone change for whatever it is, inevitably the person cannot figure out what in the world I'm talking about, because we were used to doing that all in our heads, and now it's all in a computer, which we don't know how to utilize. So it's almost like we're speaking different languages now.
Exactly. Like, for example, if you go somewhere and let's say it's $2.97 mm-hmm. and you give them $3.02, right. thinking they'll just give you a nickel, it throws them off unless mm-hmm. the cash register shows that amount. It does throw them off, because it's a different mindset for them, having to rethink that. So, yeah, that's different.
Is that one of the things that we're basically leaning on, is teaching them how to use those particular devices to make them successful in their areas?
Well, you have to let them use the new technology, but you still have to give them the basics. They still have to know how to add and subtract and multiply to be able to use a calculator. And all those sorts of things have to still be in place. Mm-hmm. I hope we never get away from that. I'm a bit concerned knowing that they're talking about not teaching cursive writing anymore.
Why in the world did they come
to
that conclusion?
Well, because of everybody using keyboards and that sort of thing. I think that what we're doing is we're taking away really more independence. Mm-hmm. You know, we think we're helping them, but in some cases you're not allowing someone to be as independent as they should be if they can't do some of those skills. You know, they may not want to write cursive, but they at least need to be exposed to it to know how to.
What are they going to do, make an X on the deed?
Well, you know, I don't know. I guess they think they'll have a BlackBerry or smartphone to do it all. I'm certainly not tech savvy, and my son would be the first to tell you that I'm a dinosaur. But I do see that technology is coming into all aspects of our life, which is good as long as there's a human touch to it. I was kind of dismayed one day. I was with my brother and sister-in-law and my niece and nephew. My niece and nephew were sitting across the table from each other. Instead of talking, they were texting each other. That was a little disconcerting. I hope that we don't lose the art of conversation and, you know, looking at someone eye to eye and conveying what you're talking about. Sure, you know, you can send them an email later, or if you're not, you know, in contact with them, get on the computer and Skype and all that kind of stuff. But let's not forget that we're still humans and we're supposed to communicate on a more human level than just the technology.
Yeah, how could you get into a fight with somebody if you've got your computers? I mean, I don't know how you would do that.
I don't know either.
Well, it's been a great show, Judy. I really have enjoyed you. It's been a lot of fun for me, and I've learned a lot.
Well, thank you.
And I'll have to have you back on.
Thank you. I appreciate that opportunity. It's always fun to come and talk with you. Thank you, Truman.
Thank you, Judy. We'll be back at 2 o'clock tomorrow.